Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast, where we are exploring the frontiers of transformational coaching. Today, I am joined by David Kitchens, who is a very experienced IFS therapist, workshop leader. He's also a couples therapist specializing in IFIO, intimacy from the inside out. So today we're going to be exploring how we can apply internal family systems in coaching. How can we do that ethically? What are some of the nuances of using IFS in coaching? David is just obviously very experienced with this approach. And so we get into some of the more nuanced understandings of the different types of parts we can encounter. We'll talk about the boundary between coaching and therapy. And we'll talk about taking IFS beyond the frame of the individual into a cultural systemic view and David's learnings around that. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Let's dive in. Here's the podcast with David Kitchens. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So David, I'm really excited to be joined with you and yeah, you know, I just really enjoyed our little check-in before we hit record. And we're going to be talking about, your work, what you're up to in the world. And how are you, first of all?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. I'm excited to be here with you. And later today, we have a Q&A around the program Following Symphony of Self. So, and we received over the last few days about 5 or 6 inches of snow, which is not uncommon, but it's becoming more uncommon. So it's lovely because all the cedars and trees are covered in snow. And so it's lovely.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful, magical.
Yeah.
Well, then let's, you mentioned the SOS, this Symphony of Self extension. And we're going to talk about IFS today, something you're, you know, you've steeped in.
Yes.
I think it's a modality now that most people, internal family systems, most people know what it is because it's exploded in
It has.
popularity over the last few years. What are you seeing? Around like that. Do you see, more and more people becoming inspired and interested by this modality?
I do. It has really taken off. Dick put the model together probably 40 years ago. I know you've met with him and had him on. And so it's been around a long time, and it's been, growing organically. And then there was the Center for Self-Leadership, and which eventually became the IFS Institute. And when I took my training starting back in 2017, I initially read about the model in 2013 when we were living in Singapore, and it was more part of my own personal development. And I was really intrigued by it. But the work I read, which was by Jay Early, was a little more manager driven. It wasn't kind of the complete model. But when I did my training in 2017, most of the people I showed up with didn't really know a lot about the model. I had, maybe it was late 2016, I had watched a 6 hour PESI video about it with Frank Anderson with some colleagues, a peer consultation group. And, we were like, okay, this is intriguing. And I had parts that really liked it, and I had parts that were pretty skeptical of it. But I started using it with clients that were pretty stable and who were comfortable with me learning a new model. I was trained psychodynamically. But we showed up, I did my level one 8 months later, and maybe we had seen a book or two. We hadn't read it. There were no videos we had seen other than like the PESI one. So we were all starting kind of together with it. Now, when folks come into a level one, some of them have waited 4 or 5 years to get into a training. They've done other programs with IFS. They've read the books. They've watched the videos. So you have a whole range of folks, some that are just kind of vaguely familiar, like I was, and some that are pretty steeped in the model. So I hear about it all the time. My wife is a leadership coach, and she'll get a client and they'll start talking parts, and she'll be like, "Do you know IFS?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I know IFS." So it's really expanding. But also, not only in the therapeutic and coaching, areas, but also it's expanding into classrooms, psychedelic work, mediation. Steffi Benderich is taking it into climate ecology, Center for Climate Psychology. So it can be used in lots of different spirituality, can be used in lots of different areas. We're hoping that, it's used more with governments, with some of the conflict we have going on in the world, social activists, it can be really helpful in that arena. So yeah, there's a lot of applications of it.
What do you think about the? I'd love to explore in a moment the impact it's had with your clients and, but what do you think about the potential for this kind of modality to help us navigate these times? You've just described all these different areas it's being applied in, and I think because for me it's such a it's so relatable in terms of human experience, that there is these different parts of me that get activated, and there are other times where I'm coming from a place that doesn't feel like parts, and
That's right.
I wonder. In a way, like a significant part of my journey was this transition from only living in parts to kind of accessing something bigger than parts, and seeing parts as parts, and so something like internal family systems, I feel like could facilitate that shift on a larger scale. And why that's beneficial for me was because it suddenly I just became more spacious, and more compassionate towards myself, and could relate to others in a more mature way. There was all these benefits that came out of it. I don't know
Yeah,
how you
absolutely.
see its potential impact on this scale.
Well, I see the impact. The impact can be really big. I appreciate your story, and like with some of Deb Dana's work around polyvagal theory, I'd be curious if we had time. I know we don't, but if you did an exercise when you weren't in that expansive state, when you were more in that kind of constricted state, how did you see yourself in the world? How did the world seem to you? And then when you're in that more expansive state, how do you see yourself in the world and how does the world seem to you? That exercise will really help you see a shift that can happen, an embodied experiential shift. And one of the distinctions I like to make is, the idea of multiplicity in parts is not new. That's been around a long time, way before the IFS model. Freud actually divided, the system up into the id, ego, superego. Lots of spiritual texts talk about multiplicity. Gestalt was talking about multiplicity, transactional analysis. There were other modalities doing that. What I feel that, Dick really brought to bear was seeing the strategies that parts use to try to take care of us, to try to get needs met, to try to protect us. I think when we limit it to a part, sometimes we start to think parts are the problem, but parts aren't the problem. We need our parts. Our parts represent our humanity. They help us get things done. They help us both be proactive and they help us play, soothe, relax. And our parts have a lot of wisdom, but they get burdened with these strategies if they're what we call protectors. And they often learn those pretty young. So these parts often don't have a toolbox of strategies. And then they're driven by vulnerability, burden, past trauma, hurt. And so what'll happen is we'll have a constraint. And then we're trying to connect instead of through vulnerability or authentic connection or from a place of integrity, we're connecting through from a place of protection. And that often results in the other person needing to respond from a place of protection. I work with couples all the time. I work with families. They get caught in these patterns of responding from places of protection of these constraints. And when you can start to get some compassion around that and some awareness and soften from the protection and drop down into vulnerability or authenticity or integrity, which does require sitting with a lot of discomfort, suddenly the conversation changes. And if you look at our world today, many people, many good people, are trapped in this constraint of protection and not feeling any connection. And helping people come to a conversation in a more open place, speaking from a place of vulnerability or integrity or essence, can dramatically shift conversations. That's where I see the model can have such power and such impact, whether it's you and your partner, you and your neighbor, or we're talking about communities under threat due to different the isms out there, or governments.
Yeah, that's beautiful because there's what that brings up for me is there's, a post system has been applied in the therapeutic paradigm, and that's very powerful because it helps people mature, to grow, integrate. It's being used in coaching. But what's beautiful about what you're sharing is that it doesn't even need to go all the way to unburdening for this model to be very impactful, actually, that there's great benefit in just understanding that at various moments, these burden parts may be activated and I might be seeing through them, seeing the world, as you said, like it seems a very particular way, and that there's a way that I can shift in those moments
That's right.
and something, then a different outcome becomes possible. And I think that's really worth highlighting here, that it's like there's a whole range of like applications. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Of course, if we're able to go and find those burdens we hold with our young, tender parts from past experience or from what's been passed down generationally through the lines or culturally, we have the shifts can be incredible to see people really have freedom from that. And then the parts that protect those younger parts don't have to operate in the same way. And as you say, we don't necessarily have to do that to help have a different perspective. Beth Zemsky, who teaches on developing cultural competence, talks about we experience our experience through the lens of our experience. So it's not necessarily what happens to us, it's how we experience what happens to us. And when parts of us get really protective, the lens of perspective starts to get really small. One fellow trainer, Latanya, talked about, when you take your hands and you make binoculars, or horses that have, the things next to their eyes so they don't see all that's what's happening. So parts really lose a lot of perspective. They don't always appreciate their impact. And they, if they're young, they don't have a lot of tools. So even just connecting from a place of compassion, patience, presence with those parts, helping to expand their perspective, and then developmentally supporting them and not being so binary in how they approach something, like either it works out perfectly or I get the hell out of there, like showing that there's a whole continuum of responses, and getting support and learning to integrate that can be transformative.
Yeah, I think this is important as well because, in the coaching field, there's, a conversation. I'm sure you're familiar with this, which is, what is the role of a coach here? What's the jurisdiction of a coach? When is it important to refer? And the most common question we had is like, can coaches work with exiles? Which might be a good, might be good in your response to kind of just, if you could just lay out the different names for the parts and but that this is a common kind of line of inquiry, and I think what you're saying for me is that's why, like, even if a coach isn't working with hurt parts, that actually in leadership, great insight and impact can occur from just understanding about parts and helping people unblend from parts and accessing essence and self. So let me come back to that question. I mean, you could just riff on what I'm saying, and in a sense, I'd love to ask you, if you could talk about the model and in particular also name, you said like being vulnerable and authentic, and is that the same as being in self, So maybe we could talk about self and the other parts and the relationship and how you see this topic. I'm putting a lot on your plate here, but and then how you see this topic of also how coaches can relate to IFS.
Lovely, lovely. And I'll riff and then just bring me back if you feel like I'm getting, there's no problem at all with that, with my system. But just generally speaking, I want to say that this is a client-informed model. And based on what different IFS practitioners have learned, there's a map that has been created about that we use to talk about the internal system and how to work with the internal system. But the map, like all maps, is not what's important. The person sitting across from you is what's important. So, I might use languaging around the map, and as Dick says, it's a pretty good map. But we just want to see that the map is kind of a learning tool. Like I will tell folks in training, if I'm following a map and it says go this way, and I get to an edge of a cliff and that cliff's not on the map, I don't keep walking because the map says to keep walking. So really being connected to the system across from you, that's the territory that's important. But the way we've kind of articulated the map that's been involved with Dick's work and many others is, so you have two classes of parts. You have protectors and then exiles. And protectors are divided into managers and firefighters. So managers are the parts of us that are proactive. They're the ones that help us get things done. They proactively try to keep from feeling or experiencing what the exile holds. That's when they're in a burden role. When they're not in a burden role, you have your parts that do your to-do list, that go to the grocery store, that, run your podcast, that whatever the case may be, like we need these parts that help us do life. But when they get burdened with a protective role, and this is where the strategy comes in. They get very attached to a strategy to not experience what the exile holds. So they can get very focused on image, focused on control. Their motto is never again. Like, if I can figure this out, I'll never experience that again. If I'm in a training and let's say something goes poorly and I feel some shame, my manager part's like, all right, I'm going to teach that again where that never happens again. And so you can work when you work with clients, whether coaching, therapy, you can see where they're really attached to their strategy. That's a manager. Firefighters, that word is used because they're reactive when they're burdened. They're putting out the fire. All they care about is getting out anyone who's hurt and putting out the fire. So they're reactive. So let's say the manager strategy doesn't work, and suddenly you're starting to feel what the exile holds. They go into action and take you out. And there's all sorts of strategies that can happen there, procrastination, getting on your phone, using a substance, shopping, all the way to suicidality. There's a whole range. And that's the reactive. Their motto is kind of like, no matter what, I'm going in there no matter what. And I'm not going to worry about the damage. And if you think about it, society often loves managers. They get really connected to our identity. Society often doesn't like firefighters. Firefighter behavior often gets shamed, it gets pathologized, it gets misunderstood. We send people to prison. Like we have a whole thing you can see around these two sources of protection. Now, when a firefighter's not in a burdened role, they're important to help us play, to help us rest, to help us relax, to help us enjoy, to be creative. I mean, managers can be creative too, but they're like, they've got that. They soothe or distract in ways that are really important. So those are the protectors. The exiles are the parts that hold burdens, and burdens are extreme beliefs or sensations or emotions that sort of get trapped around an experience, whether it's a one experience or over time or passed down or from culture. And that becomes that part's identity. It's like a coat or skin that they wear. They believe they are the part. Like, I'm worthless. I'm unlovable. I'm too much. I'm not enough. How many times have you been with somebody? They start to show emotion, and the first thing they do is they apologize. Like this messaging, something is wrong with me or who I am or how I show up. Or when people were in their essence or in their emotion, and part said, we need to get you out of here because it's not safe for you. So I'm going to exile you away. So sometimes the system cannot stand the exiles because they think they're dangerous. Sometimes they love them and they're really trying to protect them. And they don't really, it's not that they can't stand the exile, they can't stand what they represent. So when, if you and I have a conversation and you say something that lands on my exile, and I start to feel that shame or that feeling of not being worthwhile or whatever it might be, then a protector's got to come in and help out. So that's the model in a nutshell. And those are constraints. So IFS is a constraint releasing model. It's not about building people up. It's about tapping into that essence, that wisdom, that integrity, those essential qualities. And finding the con and using that to address the constraints and remove the constraints so then you can access more of that and bring more of that into the world.
That's super helpful. And actually, what you just say here is really important for me because we've talked about this on the podcast before. It's that actually a lot of coaching, if we're not careful, can be built on a kind of building people up model, to use your words. It's like, so I want some, and there's good intentions. Like, it's like, how do we get from where we are to where we want to be? But
Absolutely.
that where we want to be can be mixed in with a sense of deficiency, like if I'm more confident or if I'm better at this or at that, then then I'll be okay, you know. And actually, it's so what I'm seeing now, and we've talked about this through Symphony of Self, is models of coaching which are actually also looking at releasing constraints, because you know, there's a natural kind of healing and of growth intelligence in us, which you know, when we meet ourselves with love and acceptance, then you know, then there can be those constraints can be kind of honored for their intelligence, but then they can let they can release and something comes through. So I think this is the future of coaching too, you know, as it starts to recognize these kind of universal principles, so to speak.
Steve Marsh, who was, on your program, and he was just fantastic. He talks about the self-improvement paradigm, and at the basis of that is inadequacy. And so it's not that those F and like he said, you do come back to the developmental process, but what are you building that house on? Is it on a foundation of inadequacy, or is it on a foundation of essence, strength, and integrity? And so, I really resonated with what he shared. And I talked to when I was working with adolescents and parents, I would talk to them about building on strength all the time. Are you trying to fill a void of inadequacy, or are you building on something that is that's precious in you or strength in you? And from that place, we can build. From the other place, it's just the house of cards is there. Once you have a, there's not a lot of resilience when you build on deficiency, because the minute it gets harder, you get knocked down.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is for me the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this, and it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches, because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May.
You just drop all the way down to the bottom into hopelessness, helplessness. See, it's true. I do suck. Like parts, protectors, when they're burdened, they don't say if, they say when. It's when is this going to happen again, not if it's going to happen. And that's sort of their role. They're, when you learn about protectors and you learn to support them, you see that they're often exhausted, they're often worn out, because they can't give up the watch, because then it's their fault. And then the criticism comes in, the shame comes in. So yeah, building on this, and I think coaching, what I love about coaching, I before I became, a therapist, I spent my initial undergrad was in psychology, and I worked in community mental health. I was 22. I actually started working in inpatient psychiatric treatment centers in college, worked in community mental health, and then I ran a drug outpatient clinic at like 24, and I was like, okay, I am way too young. Like, I have my own work to do. This is overwhelming. I'm around a lot of trauma. So I went and got a law degree and loved that. But then when I started practicing law, it was so adversarial. And I wasn't working for something that I had a passion to defend. So then I went and got an MBA and worked in business. Because what I found is I loved building things. I loved building up people and things and strategy and all that. Eventually became a stay-at-home parent to three very young kids. And And then we lived in Singapore, we lived in Switzerland. And when I came back, I was like, okay, now I'm in a place to support people and really felt like I could help them. And I went through a year of discernment of how did I want to do that? So I talked to coaches, life coaches, executive leadership coaches, organizational coaches. I talked to psychologists, counselors, social workers. I talked to pastors and priests. I talked to energy workers. I talked to mediums that, I looked at all of it. And what I wanted to do the whole continuum, but I wanted to be able to work with trauma. And I felt like my system wasn't comfortable working with trauma without going to get the training. So I went into, that's why I went and got then my master's in counseling at Northwestern. But what I can feel like sometimes the therapy side misses is the integration and accountability that's on the coaching side. The moving, what do you do with it then? Our medical model, our Western medical model is one that's like, let's get you from sick to not sick, sick to zero. And then what? Then you're supposedly okay. And I love that IFS and coaching is really about getting people to being different in the world, moving in the world in a different way. And that takes some integration and it takes some accountability. Like it takes a practice. And so I have always integrated some of the elements of coaching with my therapeutic practice, which, with some systems can take years and years and years. If it's a highly traumatized system, you really have to work slowly and carefully and really attune to the person sitting across from you to what is okay for their system. But not every system is heavily traumatized. There are also systems that have the ego strength, that have the self energy, the internal container to even work with their vulnerability and their burdens, and they'll stay stable as a system, and then they can move forward into integration and accountability and where whatever they want to bring into the world.
Yeah, that's beautiful. There's so many things get touched as you share this. Like, let's bookmark the, as you're modeling, like the maturity of a practitioner, or the level of presence and attunement being, that's something I feel so strongly about. But, I notice that there are modes of therapy, like IFS. Dr. Lawrence Heller's work, where it's focusing on human thriving, and there are modes of coaching which are recognizing, what we've just talked about, that if you just kind of paper over, build a foundation over the deficiency, it's not really serving the client. Trauma-informed approaches, and it's been a topic of exploration, and like I see, I think. Of course, like the level of training is essential, and ongoing support and supervision. And we kind of, I'm curious what you think about this, but there's often a question we get, which is like, what's the boundary between coaching and therapy? And on one level, that there's some very useful ways to think about that. But actually, the more you look into it, like when you zoom in, the harder it gets to see it. Now, there's some very clear cases where you can very quickly say that's beyond the coach's scope of training, and this is where you need to be informed about referral. But I do see, and my own practice has been like, this boundary is actually quite transformational. It's actually something which is invites me into my own moral and ethical development, because I can't just be blasé and just wade into territories with my client that I'm not equipped for, and I don't want to do more harm. At the same time, I'm very passionate about helping the client come into deeper and deeper contact with themselves, and so that does involve meeting emotions, and sometimes even hurt parts that show up, and
Absolutely.
just so there's there's I think it's inviting the whole field into some important questions around how are we being invited to evolve and respond to our times when many people are coming in dysregulated, and what's our role to play, and therefore, what's our journey as a practitioner of training.
Yeah, I love all that. I really appreciate that. And I think one thing I'd like to say is, as we have these conversations, and it's, I can get quite passionate about things. And it's easy to flatten the story. It's easy to get efficient in the languaging. It's easy to say points towards generalities. But I want to acknowledge, there's nuances throughout all of this, and there are, different modes of therapy that very much focus, other than IFS, that very much focus on the client thriving. Positive psychology has been around a long time and was like that. And so some of my languaging is often around general points, but they always need to be unpacked, and there's a lot of nuance in there. So I definitely want to acknowledge that limitation, when we're talking kind of higher level macro. And if it lands, if it doesn't land well on anyone listening, I just really want to honor that and appreciate that, and would always be open to feedback around that. Another thing is, I would get a lot. There was a study out, I can't remember it exactly, and the man's name that did it, his name slips my mind. But more people were going to non-therapists than therapists. There's still a lot of stigma around going to therapy. Now, I think that's changing with the younger generation. Talking to my own kids, and it's they're much more comfortable than it used to be. But people would read my background, and they would see that I worked in business. They would see that I had a law degree. They would see that I had raised kids, that I had not been a 35 or 40 year therapist. And they would come to me because of that reason, because they were uncomfortable going to a therapist. So coaches are getting a lot of folks. And, lots of us still hold these parts that don't want to go into the history. So I really appreciate that. I have a lot of compassion for that. And yet, our clients can't decide our scope of practice.
Right.
If you are a loving, caring individual who is a coach, they are going to want to stay with you. And they may say, okay, I think I want to talk about what happened to me when I was 21, or when I was, 10, or whatever. I trust you, and I want to work with you because I trust you. And that is lovely, and it's a beautiful reflection of what you're bringing to the client. But that doesn't decide your scope of practice. We have to stay within our integrity and be able to say, I appreciate you, I care about you, but that is not what I do. And in the service of you, let's get you to somebody that can help you with that. Coaches do not have to give up the client. It can be in tandem. It can be supportive. Client can't afford it. Come back to me when you're done. But because it's, but I, what that's something that often will make me nervous when I hear folks talk is my clients would rather talk to me than a therapist. And I believe you. I believe them when I hear that. But still, you go and get training for a reason. And lots of training, which coaches can go get trauma-informed training. They can go get somatic training. You've had that on your show, those folks, Marcella, Steve, was trained in SE, somatic experiencing. I've gotten trained in Susan McConnell's work. But what I do know is I've worked with some very talented, functional people in the world that were carrying heavy trauma that no one knew about. And something can happen in their life or in their work with you while you're seeing them where they destabilize. It's not necessarily the coach's fault or the therapist's fault. It could be, but often it's something that happens. And then you have a system across from you. Do you know what to do with it? Do you know how to support that person? All of a sudden, you're like, wow, I am out of my depth. That can happen quickly. And, we make wise decisions often because of the 3 to 1% of what can happen. Is it common? No, but it happens. And you don't want to find yourself suddenly in that situation. I mean, let me check with you. How's that landing?
Yeah. Well, no, it's, I think it's fantastic you bring it up. And I think because a lot of coaches can be fearful of this, and I parts can get activated first of all, which is so it's a beautiful moment of like professional development and in the sense of meeting oneself. And I think so I love that you bring this up, and I think one thing is it's you said it doesn't happen that often, so that's important to say, but it does, but it can happen. And I think I'd love to stay with it, and this is why I think coaches need to be trauma informed, or because then you can learn about what to do when it happens rather than just not knowing. And it doesn't mean you start doing therapy with that client, but it's also not good if you just go like, okay, stop, you know, okay, don't, because you can reach, you can traumatize her parts if they suddenly show up. And I think trauma parts could become hurt if they're reject if they feel rejected. So what my question really is, like, what do you think is in those moments,
That's
what
lovely.
is the right thing to do? Like, how this is a good educational moment for coaches to kind of get an understanding. What are the signs when something comes through that's destabilizing for a client, and you know, what should a coach be asking themselves in that moment, and what can they do?
I remember reading from one of the participants in Symphony of Self. You know, they talked about trauma sensitive, trauma informed, and then trauma trained. Like, there is a range around trauma, and having at least an idea of knowing how to what to watch out for trauma when you're maybe getting to that area. That is one thing I would recommend folks, coaches ought to go take some sort of trauma training that helps them be more sensitive and informed. I feel like it's just the ethical thing to do. Even if you're an executive leadership coach, you know, my partner, she has no interest in doing any type of therapeutic work with clients. No interest at all. She doesn't get near it. She refers out quickly. She's very comfortable with that. But for her to know the signs is still important. So, that's one thing I want to share. Also, so many of us, most of us, not all of us, had experiences when we were younger that when we were overwhelmed. So, trauma is what happens inside of us because of what happens to us. And it's often being alone and not having the resources to make sense of it. And then there's some sort of fragmentation that happens. The situation can't be integrated, and therefore it gets trapped in our body, it gets trapped in different parts of our psyche. And there is an integration that never happened around it. So when you start to have a person who might be having a moment of disintegration or defragmentation or something in front of you, one of the most healing things you can do, even though that person is still going to need support, is to meet them with care, validation, and the importance of it's good that we're here and you can get the support you deserve. And to work with your own parts that you don't panic or send them the message that they're too much.
Exactly, right.
It is in service of you that I want to get you to somebody who is highly trained to support you and care about you and help you now get to integrate and process what happened so that you can be in the world in a much more expansive way. So you can love, so you can be present, so you can be more creative. Because trauma causes our world to get very small and very contained and very protected. And that's not anyone's fault, and it's not the protector's fault. But now there's a chance to do something about it. So being able to meet intense vulnerability and validate it and say, we're going to get you support, and letting that person have a corrective emotional experience around their own experience that's coming up. Coaches can do that, and they can do that well.
Yeah, beautiful. And I guess I'm curious what you think about the couple of questions come up. I'll ask this one first. The importance of understanding about our nervous systems. You mentioned Depdana, and you know, understanding things like you know, orientation. So you know, would it, so you know, all the things you just said, and you know, maybe helping a client to just kind of ground a little bit more, without imposing that you should ground onto that person in the moment, but knowing some things like, I've found that before with clients where it's like, well, let's just take a moment to look around the space and just see if there's anything that your attention gets drawn to that feels, you're curious, and then they can start to regulate through that, which helps them then in the transition talking about referral or,
That's right.
having them not leave the session in a completely dysregulated state. I think I've only done that once or twice in 15 years of coaching,
Yeah.
but still, it was fantastic in that moment. So again, the caveat here is not to kind of, you've got to, any little thing like that, you also need to kind of be very attuned in the way you use it, that it's not, being imposed on somebody is like something they should do
Right.
to change them,
Well, yeah,
so.
you're working on what is, trying to be careful of the message you're sending them.
Right.
So Deb Dana's work is based on Stephen Porges' work, and Stephen Porges and his son, I can't remember his son's name, have put out a recent book that's lovely. But first and foremost, we are mammals, we co-regulate. Some systems don't really, well, they weren't taught to co-regulate, and they try to auto-regulate. They try to regulate themselves and they get overwhelmed, and that doesn't work. So one of the things the coach can do is really know their own nervous system
Right.
and what is happening in my system as the person across from me is starting to get dysregulated. So and what I'd love to do, Joel, is I'd love to get some generalities, but in our time together, there's no way I can give, of course, and you know that
Right.
there's no way I can give people, here's how to handle a dysregulated client.
Right, exactly. We're not teaching people in this moment what to do. We're just giving a sense of, it's like a what's possible here, and that we
Right.
should go away and train
Yeah.
and tra become trauma informed, etc. Yeah.
Beautifully. But step one is, I really check my nervous system. I slow down. I slow down my breathing. I'm really present. I'm letting them know that I'm not getting dysregulated because they're dysregulated. And I want them to hear I'm right there with them. If they're in a hyper state, if they're like getting manic, I am helping them, I'm connecting with them cognitively. To really like some of what you're talking about, I'm here. Are you able to take me in? Are you able to take in what's around you? It's in service of that part that's getting very activated. But I also want to see it as the nervous system too. What is going to help the nervous system start to release a little bit? Stephen Levine talks about, where being in a car accident. And he's there on the ground, and his nervous system is doing all these things. And there was a woman who came up with a nurse. I may not have the story exactly right, but I think I'm close. And she was just like, I'm here with you. And she stayed connected while he went through the process of what his nervous system needed to do. What we often do is try to stop the nervous system, medicate it, shut it down, calm down. We try to control and contain. And so, how's your nervous system? Are you able to connect with the person across from you? And what's going to help them start to just come down a little bit in their activation? One of my mentors talked about, she had a woman who had just been in a car accident and she held hands with her and they jumped up and down. Like it helped release some of that energy because a lot of this is energy. But they're in a downregulated hypo state. A lot of your cognitive interventions are not going to work, but we're talking about working with the body more. We're talking about, can you move your toes? Can you move your hands a little bit? I'm right here with you. We're taking our time. We're letting them slowly start to come back. So there are things to do. And, a really good trauma training program, again, versus being informed and sensitive. Can help you in those moments. And I love what you said. It's happened twice in 15 years. The thing is you don't want it to have it to happen, and then you're like, oh, what do I do? And now you get dysregulated, and they see you dysregulated, it's going to dysregulate them more. And it's So I really highly recommend getting that training and the resources that are out there, and so much good information out there now today that people can get.
Yeah, beautiful. That's super helpful. Like I love hearing about this. And yeah, again, like I hope this inspires people to go and train more and get more informed. And the second question that came up was around the difference between someone experiencing an emotion that comes up. I mean, this is, it's very, you'd have to be very, it's very unique to each person, but the difference between someone experiencing an emotion as opposed to a hurt part coming up. I've had coaching clients where, something just happened to a family member, and it would have been, it would just wouldn't have been right to kind of go back to the leadership topic. It's like this was just really present, so we just gave space for them to just name what was here in relationship to that. And again, it was regulating. It was the emotion moved through, and we could just welcome what was arising. And was that a part in them that was activated? Could well have been, but it was very valuable, and for me felt well within the scope of the coaching to help them just presence that emotion that was there. So do you see a difference between just there being these emotions that can show up and hurt parts, or?
Well, we, you know, with the young tender parts, like we talk about the burdens and, trauma, there is, there, I'm trying to remember where I heard this so I can give the person credit, but I think the name will come to me. But there is some concern in the trauma field that we're calling everything trauma. And trauma, is something that gets lodged in the nervous system, gets lodged in the body, it gets lodged in the psyche. And so, again, being trauma trained, informed, and sensitive helps you start to delineate that a little bit, because life is hard. We're humans. We have emotions. We have days when we are not doing well. It's not like a coach is only about positivity and self-improvement and how do we help you, become great. Like, that coaching is able to work with the experience people are having, which can be hard, upsetting. If somebody is in an environment, a work environment, where somebody is being overbearing and demeaning and shaming, and or they're a person in a marginalized identity and they're constantly dealing with power dynamics and structural dynamics that are harming them, impacting them, we can make space to work with that and be with that and understand that. And there could be a lot of emotion there. And we have to kind of watch for that cultural burden of emotions are bad. And that's patriarchy. Patriarchy very early teaches boys first and then girls to not be connected to their emotion. And if you are connected to your emotion, girls are given lots of labels of being hysterical or crazy or out of control. And there's a lot of labels put on boys who later become men if they're emotional. So emotions are critical to our survival. They're important for living and feeling alive, and they give us really good information. That is not trauma necessarily. And that's not necessarily then, oh, you need to go see a therapist. What I find is that, and I really don't find this in my work because I can do both, but I find it in supporting other coaches and talking to my partner. If a person can't move through an experience, if they get stuck on it and it's intense and emotional, there's something deeper there that probably needs the attention and the container that a therapist provides. But if you have a relationship with them, I think of it a lot, Joel, around this idea of a container, the internal container. Do they have the internal container that can hold discomfort, upset, uncertainty, overwhelm, confusion, developmental edges? Can their container hold that? If their container can't hold that, they need a therapist. They need somebody to understand what kept that container from being formed and how to develop and strengthen their container so they can be with what's happening to them in their life. Some people have that container, and then a coach is able to help them integrate and process what's happening in their life in the service of removing the constraint and moving into self-leadership, moving into integrating it and being different in the world. And to me, then, yeah, you learn to, but then again, where I want to go in the program following Symphony of Self, I love Symphony of Self. I just want to give you a lot of credit and the people on your team and the people you had in to present. I thought it was really a lovely program. And the next step for me is getting people more familiar with their own system. What
Exactly,
I
yeah.
have found transformative in my work is the more depth I get with my own system, the more I can create possibility and hold space for people sitting across from me. It's a parallel process. And so, am I comfortable sitting in front of somebody who's overwhelmed and then gets blended with a part that says, Joel, you need to help me fix this. This isn't being fixed. It's not changing. They bring in that sense of urgency because they're feeling hopeless. Can I sit with that? Can I be patient with that? Can I meet that? Can I validate that? And then can I get underneath it? What are you afraid would happen if we never fix this? What is the hope here? What's the fear here? Like, I got to be, my container needs to be able to hold that container for a little bit. And then as they learn to see that we can hold that, their container gets even stronger. That's what we do in therapy too, but it's just a much slower, careful, client-led process. We move at the speed of trust. Some systems don't trust for good reason. Other systems haven't had the same experiences. Developing trust is a little bit easier. So I, when I'm consulting coaches, I'm asking them to be assessing the container of the person sitting across from them. And when, my partner will, let's say a consultee will say, this is the fifth time I've been through this issue with the person and it keeps coming up. I'm like, there's something historical there that needs to be addressed. And I would recommend, again, not leaving them, but referring them out for how many ever sessions it takes. Be in relationship with that therapist. Get a release so you can talk to them about it. And then after the therapist has worked with that person for a few sessions, collaborate with them and see what their take is on the system, because they have training for that. Or get them to a psychiatrist, or get them to a psychologist for an assessment, or get them to a body worker. Like, our work can be a very lonely business. And I think it's part of the, again, these are my parts, Joel, but I think it's part of the Western medical cultural model, the machine that says keep everybody in isolation. But if we're in gr if we're working collaboratively with folks, we can really do service to an individual, because it's unrealistic to think they're going to come see me for an hour a week or an hour every other week, and that's necessarily going to be enough for them to get what they need. We need to broaden our scope. That's the other thing I want to do in the second half of the program, is I want to talk sometimes not so much about the individual, but broaden the scope. I want to bring in family legacy impact, cultural impact, biology, identity, expand that scope, eco, the world around us, the planet, like broaden our scope and get into more some collective healing and collective support. So the coach is an important part of that, a critical part of that, in my opinion. It's just knowing kind of where you fit in the puzzle at that time and space in that moment.
So you just brought some really important topics in, the maturity of the coach. But let's stay where you just left off. I love what you're saying. I've been thinking about this, that in an enlightened future, We'll have like teams of practitioners who can, one person can kind of be connected to that team, and the right person can step in at any moment with their speciality and their, who they are as a person that can help that person with exactly what they need. Because yeah, it's to think that I can help all people with everything is, it's just not going to happen that way. So I think I think we're close to breaking out of some of the models we've trapped ourselves in, like the hour once every week, the hour once every 2 weeks. I think technology will play a role in it. But I think, yeah, there's going to be interesting kind of innovation around teams, teams of practitioners. And could you say more about broadening the scope itself, and what you're going to be teaching? Like, what's because let me just before you answer that, the other thing is we've kind of trapped ourselves in this notion of hyper individuality. Like, and I think that's part of the malaise that we're experiencing is people feel I've got to do it all myself. They feel lonely and disconnected. And so there's a kind of worldview shift taking place, which I think IFS is kind of part of this kind of transition. There's no wonder there's a reason why it's getting so popular right now. Like it's tapping into something. So could you say something about what I'm sharing and the importance of broadening scope? What is that?
I really appreciate that. And I want to both appreciate IFS and I want to say this is one of IFS's growing edges. Because in the individualistic cultures that we, not all of us, but many of us live in, and not all ethnic groups, some ethnic groups are really collective and they support each other and they're we need wisdom without appropriate misappropriating it. We need the wisdoms from different cultures of how to do this. But you come in to see me and I'm like, how do I help you remove your constraints so you can be different? And what I can say, even if I don't mean to, the impact can be you're the problem. And I really encourage people to read Resmaa Menakem's work. We decontextualize my grandmother's hands. We decontextualize the situations, we decontextualize things, and then we make it about the individual. And systems of oppression want us to do that. They want us to stay individual because if we get collective and we start calling things out from a collective place with power in the collective, that is going to really be hard for systems of power. So I want to say we do need our internal container so that we can be our so we can be a part of the collective. So I do see the place for individual work, but we also need an external container. We're mammals. We need to matter. We need to feel like we belong. So what's your external container? Who's on your team? When I worked with adolescents, and my wife would do this because she works a lot with women. That was one of her passions, is empowering women in leadership. And it's like, who's on your board of directors, your own board of directors? Who do you go to who's your champion, who believes in you and helps you so that you're not having to figure all this out yourself? But to do that, we ourselves have to hold a larger lens. And this is where IFS can get tricky. Thomas Huble is doing a lot of this collective work. A lot of community activists are doing this beautiful collective work. When I work with you and I start with your issue and I hear it and I reflect it back and we pick a part to work with and we work with that part, the challenge is that part doesn't understand the water it swims in. That's the implicit bias. We experience our experience through the lens of our experience. So this is where I think we as the coach offer, we invite, we don't tell. But we invite what else is happening that's larger than this? What's happening outside of your world? What's happening in that organization? Rarely do I work with somebody in an organization and do I not find what they're experiencing is being experienced in the organization. So they're not necessarily the problem. What's happening in the organization is the problem. People that are dealing with external constraints, when they're dealing with systems that are working against them, but we are taught to take responsibility for that, to make meaning of that about ourselves, because we're meaning-making machines. So when you help somebody detach from that making meaning and taking responsibility for, it can be liberating. Now you've got the rage, the anger that's really needed. You've got the grief. You can really address some of the helplessness because we don't have power individually over somebody's system. Need to acknowledge that. One of the myths of self-energy is that if I get into all this self-energy, I can change everything outside of my world. But that's not true. That's true for a lot of white people who have been in a lot of positions of privilege, but it's not necessarily true for people that are in marginalized positions. But what we can work it with is the meaning you made because of those systems of power. Or what's it like to be seeing our planet being used up and destroyed all around us? Now, there's existential anxiety that we're not talking about. So it require, and for a new coach, for a new therapist, this languaging can be very overwhelming. So start where you are. You don't have to figure it all out. You know, part of learning, and I believe the person who started Hakomi, Ron Kurtz, talked about, you know, we always have to start. We learn a protocol and we're really diligent to the protocol. That's how we learn it. But then once we get it in our bones, we throw it away. It's still there, but now we can be more organic with it. So start with where you are. But what I want to invite folks to be thinking about, what are the larger systems at play? What else is impacting the client? And how do we support the client in getting creative in how to expand their external container so it's holding them and helping them get the connection they need, helping them find their purpose? Here's what's tricky about the model, in my opinion. Like, if IFS is going to be a model of liberation, we need to help parts sit in a lot of discomfort. And a client may come to you wanting to go one direction, but as you do the work with them, you may find it doesn't actually align with their deeper sense of purpose or their integrity or their essence. All of those, their presence, which I consider umbrellas of when we use that word self. And then they're going to be in a difficult spot to decide, do they keep going down that road or do they get aligned with what's inside? And I've supported people who have made both choices, some that have decided not to, and some that decided to, you know, change, like we recontract, so to speak. But it's tricky business then when you get to those deeper questions.
Just to get my head around that, could you say a bit more about the it sounds like what you're in those moments you're reaching the edge of the model in terms of where it how it aligns with where the co where the client might want to go as opposed to where the model might want to take them. Is that do I have could you say a bit more about the
No, I appreciate that very much because what the model can definitely go there. The thing is that we can get caught up in our own way of being hyper individualistic and using the model.
Gotcha. Right.
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't say that so clearly. And I'm really glad you asked for clarification. The model can handle the expansiveness of the individual and the collective. You know, working with families and couples and employees, you know, colleagues. There is a way for systems to drop into what's happening inside of me. What's, you know, what protective strategy am I trying to use? What's my hope in that? What's my fear if I don't use that strategy? Then how's that landing on the other person? There's ways to work this collectively for sure. But we are so indoctrinated. Like I said, it's the water we swim in. We can get so indoctrinated into self-energy in you, the internal attachment in you. I'm going to get so solid that now I go out into the world and I'm not messy. And you see what I mean? And actually, we're all messy. Like the more we can start connecting around our messiness and our uncertainty and our lack of knowing, which actually makes space for something to unfold. That's where, that's what I'm talking about, Joel.
This is, I think, something important in terms of, like I was on a retreat this year where the teacher was talking about our, being even keeled, like that was his expression, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm so committed to that as a kind of, principle that like I can. If I'm feeling dysregulated, if I'm feeling uncertain and unclear and reactive, then I can shift back into presence, by including what's here. And there's actually a profound, beautiful truth in that, actually, that I don't want to throw that out. But it's also, where is that mixed in with our addiction to being clear, to being in the right place, or we should always be in self with a capital S, and that's where, and then suddenly we've made it a thing. We've kind of reified it, and it's now come kind of fixed and static, as opposed to, and it's kind of reinforcing that separate hyper individualistic identity, as opposed to what I think you're pointing to, which is, like on a fundamental level. We are deeply relational, and that we are, we're co-arising, really. Like we've had Dan Siegel on the podcast talking about Mui, and I think this is important. Yeah, the place where I, so this I'm kind of, maybe this is a bit of a segue, but I want to bring it in. It's like, on the one hand, it's powerful that we are able to start to recognize the deep patterning, the interconnections, that there are cultural contexts, that we've got lineages, and there's been oppression and all kinds of harm caused by groups to other groups, and we're all culturally situated with inside of these systems that. So we're opening to that. And then on the other hand, how do we do that in a way that we don't reinforce a sense of victimhood? Like not to say there are not victims, because there are, but I mean more like, that I noticed in my own life there was a powerful shift where, I noticed like I w and it I think it gets to the nervous system topic again, where I would be in a certain state, and it would be like, well, it's all happening to me, and it's the world's fault. It's my child's fault, or it's my wife's fault. And then suddenly I'm putting all responsibility out there, and it's like, yeah, I'm persecuted by them. And then now I'm othering that person. So this is the kind of trickiness with the privilege conversation, because suddenly now I'm a white guy, and I'm therefore I'm just privileged, whereas I also suffer. And some people might say, you're not allowed to because you're a privileged white guy. So it just gets quite, is I think we've got to be nuanced with it. And so my point is, this is where I felt like self actually comes in, because in a way there's a place where we can like include all of the kind of hurt that's been caused, but without polarizing around it. Just as we are individually, like polarized parts can come up, and now suddenly I can, rather than being in one part fighting the other, I can be in a space where they can start to be seen. How could we do that on a collective level where we can honor there's hurt, and but then we're not in a place where we're suddenly polarizing again and reducing people to labels, or generalizing people, is it, and I don't have clear answers to it, but it seems like we need a way through that isn't polarizing.
So let me see if I can track that, because I saw some kind of a arc through what where you went just there. So one thing is, I am always curious about this term spiritual bypass. And it's like I'm dysregulated. Something's happening in me. I am going to get to a calm state and now I'm okay. And the question to me is like, what are you afraid would have happened if you hadn't gotten to that calm state? Or what did you bypass? Maybe not, maybe you didn't. Like, it's just a question, it's not an assumption. But what did you bypass in going there? And, I really love Steve March's comment. I loved how he framed this because we've talked about this in IFS from the beginning, but he framed it in experience distant versus experience near. When you went to that calm place, were you still experience near with everything you were just holding, or did you actually get experience distant? And if you actually find, because when we unblend, unblending for me, like that's a word that's tricky for me and I don't always like it. To me, it's being in relationship with instead of being completely in it. It's like unblending is not ending relationship. It's having some space to then be with it in a more connected way. So when you move into a we or you move into a calm state, are you still with? So that's one thing I wanted to say. Like, I'm asking people, what are you afraid would happen if you didn't go into that space? And if there's anything in there around the burden or the fear of collapse, whatever the case may be, can we talk about that? Can we get curious about that and see what we can unfold? Because lots of practices, beautiful practices, are around being with the depth of our experience without being overwhelmed or taken over by it. So that's the first point I'd like to kind of address. The second point, yes, there's lots of language and labels around identities and privilege and that sort of thing. But you said a key word in there to me that often people move away from or don't really address, which is the othering. Is where I'm going with that conversation calling in and wanting to stay in relationship, or is it othering? That's one question I hold. The other question I hold is, how deeply do I know the experience of the other person? So, and I love Dr. Ken Hardy's work, but when he talks about privileged selves and subjugated selves, we all have privilege and we all have subjugated selves. We've all had experience of being subjugated. But when we're in the presence of somebody that's in a subjugated position, really, we put our privileged experience aside and we center that in the goal of being in relationship. And what I have found is that when I get very curious and from a place of humility, learn more about the experience of a person sitting across from me, I get less worried about labels and whether I'm being included or not included. But it requires, back to what I said before, which we have to talk about more, in my opinion, the model. Can I sit in that discomfort? Can I sit in that discomfort that the other person is not going to center me, not going to center my experience, not ex center my past harm, but it's really going to be about them? And when I do that, then I learn more about me. And I'll go back to Beth Zemsky's work about culture. Developing culturally, becoming culturally developed, then I can really get to know my experience, my culture. I can meet somebody else again. It goes back to my work. So let me see how that's landing, because
Yeah,
this
that's
topic we could have three podcasts, four podcasts on. It's really good. So I just want to touch on it, and I really don't want to in any way be complicit with this idea that, not saying that you're saying this at all, I'm just saying it's out in the world that because I'm privileged, I'm being harmed by people, that whose identities and whose experiences are being centered over mine. And therefore, I now have no place in the world. Like that is an argument of the systems of power that want to keep us separate.
I
And
think,
yeah,
yeah, go, sorry, go ahead, yeah.
I'll say this last thing. I love what Beth Zemsky says. We need to be really hard on systems of power and gentle with each other.
Yeah, I wanted to let that one just kind of land in the space. It's beautiful.
Thank you for
And
getting all that out.
I love what you're sharing. Like I'm just sitting here listening very deeply, and I can feel the level of care and discernment, you know, that you've dedicated to exploring this. And I think this is a really important topic because you know, I'm guilty of bypassing, spiritual bypassing. I've done that, and I still do it. I still do it, but I do it a lot less than I used to. And you know, I think it's almost like a kind of, if we're not careful, any model we take on, whether that's a meditation practice or IFS, can be used to bypass. You know, it can be
That's right.
co-opted in order to avoid the discomfort. And my bias is that the discomfort is where the evolution will take place. You know, that there's actually a lot of discomfort surfacing in the world right now. I've
That's
heard
right.
some people say to me, the reason that's taking place is because there's more light in the world than there's ever been, and it's allowing, you know, these systems of oppression and the, you know, if we use the light and dark metaphor, the dark to come in to be met. But I think it's just incredibly important that we're not using anything to distance ourselves from experience or one another. And I think my, you know, if I share like my vulnerability that gets touched is my parts that get triggered, it's less about fearing that I'll be displaced from the center, because actually it feels kind of relieving to be in a world where there's a recentering of certain cultures and wisdoms that have been marginalized. Like I feel like you mentioned patriarchy, and so there's something kind of tiring about the systems. I mean, so, but I think it's like the vulnerability comes when I'm just called like a cis white man, you know, and then that's like how I'm being related to. And I think there's a whole generation of young men who felt kind of disenfranchised from being told they're the problem, and that I don't want to be complicit in that either. So it's just a very nuanced topic. And anyway, if I'm just really sat with a lot of gratitude for the way you've immersed yourself in this work as we come to the end of our conversation, and really valuing the situating the framework, the model within how we hold it as a practitioner, and the necessity for our maturity, which includes broadening our scope of understanding and becoming aware of the cultural kind of in conditions that we've imbibed within us. Like Steve, who's been a mentor of mine, has this saying, which I think he's, you know, been influenced by other people, and I can't name those names. I don't know, but it's like the transformation that's occurring is not actually happening in the individual, really. It's happening in the culture. That's where really which is kind of a strange thing to, when you first hear it, it's kind of strange. It's like that doesn't make any sense. But I think it's pointing towards what we're talking about, that there's this deep intimacy between
Yes.
us moment by moment and how we arise. I don't know if there's anything you want to share as a kind of closing kind of, I don't want to call it a statement, but you know, just to close, if there's anything you want to
Yeah.
share.
Well, I so deeply appreciate you speaking about your own vulnerability and what touches you. I would love for folks to consider reading Carol Gilligan's work around her book, latest book, In a Human Voice. She really talks about patriarchy. And, the comment about what boys are taking on and how they're feeling disenfranchised. Just take a look at that work and see what, if it impacts folks around what patriarchy does to boys so early, and that it's the systems we need to really go after, not each other. And we need men, we need women too, but we need men guiding these young men to get back in touch with their bodies, back in touch with their vulnerability, back in touch with their essence and their voices of resistance, not towards other women or other men, but towards the systems that told them their value was in what they do and how they're seen in the world, versus finding their value in connection and in embodiment. And to me, it becomes a foundation for so much pain and hurt in these young men. And so I appreciate you speaking to that. And yeah, it just really touched me to hear that. And so, yeah, I'm just holding a lot of gratitude getting to be here with you and getting to have these talks again. I just want to, with all we covered and the efficiency of language, some of what I share is not right or not exactly said. And if it really landed poorly with someone, please let me know. I'd love to hear about that and keep my own learning going. But appreciate the work you're doing. Appreciate getting to connect with you. And yeah, maybe we can talk again sometime.
And yeah, I love that. And where can we find out more about your work as well? If there's people who feel inspired to.
I'm kind of a Luddite. Like, I don't really have any social media presence. I don't have much of a website. So, yeah, there's a few offerings I'm doing here and there. But I mean, I am on LinkedIn, but I haven't updated in a year. So, I have to kind of, I have a parts a little embarrassed about that in today's world, but I've always just kind of been a dinosaur when it comes to those things. So, they can email me, they can maybe go to LinkedIn, and I'm working on getting all that updated.
Nice. Just a little that appreciate that. And also I had someone talking about the phrase Luddite, and did you know that it actually in back in the day it was actually a huge compliment, because the Luddites were people who were very discerning about what they took on, and how it impacted their culture and their ways of living. So
Yeah.
I think we need to reappropriate. I mean, it's actually like becoming, we should start to reconsider
Yes.
being a Luddite with AI coming in and everything, like to
Yeah.
have that level of discernment. So, yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because I'm very cautious around hyperbole and, marketing myself. Yeah, I have lots of parts up around it. So thank you for that. I love that reframe, and yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks, David. Here we are, we're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.